CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, this is UBC Arts on Air. I'm your host, Irene Dell. Each week, we feature the ideas and stories of students and staff within the Faculty of Arts at the University of British Columbia. Today, Professor Luke Clark, Director of the Center for Gambling Research at UBC, part of the Department of Psychology. Luke, it's a great pleasure to have you here.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, I want to begin with the idea of gambling, and this may seem like a slightly odd question, but could you outline a history of gambling or gambling in the modern era?
Yeah, we know that gambling has been around for a very long time. So astragaloi are these knuckle bones from sheep that the ancient Greeks used to gamble effectively, to gamble for money and other objects. And we see gambling in the vast majority of cultures around the world, and going back through ethnographic analyses, back through history. And this for me, you know, is one of the paradoxes and really the reason how I got interested in gambling research. Generally, you know, people know that the odds of gambling are stacked against them. Certainly in modern day gambling and commercial gambling, the house always wins. So if it's so ingrained, you know, how do we reconcile those two things? It's sort of prevalence, it's ubiquity with that knowledge that you know, the odds are really loaded against you, and if you continue to gamble, you're going to lose money. So that was how I very much got interested in the field.
So, is there a psychology of the gambler or a gambler? I don't necessarily mean someone who's a compulsive gambler, but naturally, do we like to gamble? Is this an innate quality, do you think?
I think, yeah, we've been interested very much in, I suppose, that from two approaches, the game and the gambler. So we're very interested in the features of gambling games that make them fun, and whether these are the same features that might underlie them becoming excessive for some people. And at the same time, we're interested in problem gamblers as well, and the characteristics and the differences between people there, how you might get two gamblers who are playing, you know, recreationally, playing as a form of entertainment. They can be playing in very similar ways, and for one person that spirals out of control, and for another person it doesn't. And yeah, I'm really keen to understand the differences there and that transition of how this behavior becomes out of control.
Yeah. So it's a sort of behavioral problem, or a biological problem, or some sort of combination between the two?
Well, it is now recognized as a form of behavioral addiction. So it is the first recognized behavioral addiction. And this is just as of last year in the DSM-5, which is the psychiatric guidelines for classifying mental health problems. Gambling was actually moved Problem gambling was moved into the addictions category for the first time, and it's the only disorder in that category that isn't a substance addiction, so it's the only behavioral addiction. And this actually changes, you know, the way that we think about addiction itself. You know, the very term addiction has always been linked to pharmacology, the pharmacology of how those drugs work on the brain. So when we start thinking about behaviors being addictive as well as drugs, it's a conceptual shift, and I think there are actually a lot of quite deep conceptual issues that we still need to resolve there.
A few moments ago, you used the phrase commercial gambling. So do you make a distinction between commercial and private or personal gambling?
Well, you could see games of chance, and you can see these in developing cultures. There's been some work in Tanzania, for example, where gambling is used within societies basically as a way of moving valuable objects around the members, the families within that society. So things like knives and other cooking utensils. And that's viewed quite positively within those societies. It's clearly quite an adaptive thing. With commercial gambling, of course, you know, everything changes with the house edge. You know, the casino always wins, and you know this goes by various different catchphrases and terms. And it's that means that if a gambler continues to play on these games, they will inevitably lose money in the long term.
So distinctions in culture as well as practice, so to speak. So gambling in Asia may differ from gambling in the Nordic countries or in Southern Europe?
I think that's also true. Yeah, we can see some cultural differences, certainly within Chinese culture. Gambling is very widespread, and there are some cultural differences there, for example, in luck and superstitions. But even within Western cultures, you can see that the way gambling is legislated is very specific to any jurisdiction. And that can be in terms of what forms of gambling are legal, whether it's available online. In Canada and in BC, we have very much a state monopoly approach to gambling. In the UK, where I was before, it was very much privatized. And this means that in any area, in any jurisdiction, we need local research, and in a way that's where the Centre for Gambling Research at UBC has come about. We've had very, very little research on gambling in BC, even though Alberta, Ontario and Quebec are three real driving forces at an international level in this field.
So can you elaborate research? How do you go about doing research? You cited British Columbia. What do you do?
Well, we do work on the games, and we do work on the gamblers, and those are two strands really that come together.
So will I find you at the Red Rock Casino?
We have recently been to the Red Rock just to kind of
get
a measure.
I know it's all research. Picasso said every painting is research, right?
Yeah. We needed to know. You know, what are the array of games that are out there in BC, and particularly here we're very interested in machine gambling, and this is one area, you know, where the technology has changed enormously over the last 20 or 30 years, from very kind of old fashioned one arm bandit three reel games to the kind of modern games now where you have a lot of themes from film or from video gaming, the bonus features of these games, just the bells and whistles in terms of the sound effects and visuals have changed rapidly. And these games, there are many different games available, and there are a lot of different psychological features within these games. So in a way, it's often feels like very piecemeal work a lot of the time, that we're trying to unpick in our experiments, you know, what's the effect of the speed of the game, or what's the effect of the number of near misses, or what's the effect of, you know, the intensity of the bells and whistles. And we sort of go through these things one by one, trying to look at how sort of powerful that device is, basically.
Do you ever get involved with the designer of some of these games and machines? I mean, obviously it's a world different than video games and perhaps older, but nevertheless, these companies that create these machines and other kinds of gaming devices, do you ever investigate their principles or how they go about upgrading? In other words, they have to also be a little bit ahead, right, of the player.
Yeah, I think that the technology advances very rapidly there. But I see it as being a sort of rapid evolution in some respects, that a game designer or a slot machine company knows very rapidly from the revenue on the casino floor which games are working and which games are not working. And I think they keep the features that work and drop the features that don't work. And in that respect, it's a bit like kind of rapid trial and error learning. And what I feel we're trying to do is, you know, after the fact, try and it's a bit like backwards engineering, try and work out exactly what was going on in those sort of natural experiments. We've done a lot of work there. In particular, we've been interested for many years in looking at the effects of near miss outcomes. And these are a feature that you see within all forms of gambling, but they're very common within machine gambling.
What is a near miss feature?
Also, a near miss in a horse race, say, would be just a narrow neck-to-neck finish. So the horse you've bet on comes in second place. You know, you're very close to the big payout, but you've just missed it. And in machine gambling, you know, classically, if you've got two cherries on the pay line, you see the third cherry stopping just short. And gamblers certainly tell us that these are meaningful. They're quite special events. They seem to drive continued play. And at the same time, those events are objectively no different from completely missing. You know, these are all losses, and we should lump them all together.
Do you actually have the opportunity to interview gamblers, and are gamblers forthcoming? Do you find that they are honest in their reaction to, well, your investigations?
So in the UK, for a long time, we've been working with a treatment clinic in central London, the National Problem Gambling Clinic in the UK, which is actually the only specialist service in treating problem gamblers in the UK. And we've been doing a variety of studies there, looking at some biological markers in problem gamblers attending the clinic. We look at the basic foundations of decision making using cognitive testing in those gamblers. And we're also interested in the broader clinical profile here. We see a lot of other mental health problems, particularly depression and anxiety, and particularly other substances, mainly alcohol and nicotine. And really one of the main challenges for the next year is to build up a similar resource in Vancouver, and we're looking at working with some of the treatment programs that the BC Lottery Corporation offer through their treatment program, and we'll also be looking at recruiting from casinos and recruiting through general advertising as well. And interviews are going to be a part of that, but a lot of what we do is quantitative research, trying to measure decision-making and operationalize different aspects of decision-making and study them in gamblers.
Would you ever consider the reverse, interviewing people who don't gamble and who don't want to gamble and may be afraid to gamble?
Well, I think that's been a shift in the last couple of years, is towards treating this much more as a continuum and a full spectrum. And I suppose this is moving away from a traditional medical model. And, you know, even if you just look back in the literature a decade or so, it's very much dominated by research that takes quite severe problem gamblers in treatment and people who don't gamble at all and looks at the differences between those. But we can see now that probably the diagnosis of problem gambling was a bit too strict. We can certainly see that people who don't meet that diagnosis can still have a lot of the harms of gambling in terms of job and family disruptions and debt and borrowing. We need to understand this full spectrum. And I suppose I hadn't quite thought about it from the direction you raised there, but maybe we should be asking, if 3/4 of the population gamble, at least occasionally, maybe we should do some studies, really try to look at the quarter who don't and whether there's anything different about them.
Well, is it related, I mean, the idea of gambling to the notion of A, I want to win, so I have this winning desire, or B, competition. I like competition. And I may have achieved what I wanted in my career or in my job, and now I'm looking for other forms of competition, and gambling is a quick way of measuring my success or failure. I mean, are they related to ideas of that, do you think, in some fashion?
I think the competition can come in terms of a sense of expertise or a sense of mastery, trying to beat the system. So you see that a lot in sports betting, really, you know, studying form guides for hours. Whether that comes in, I think a lot of other forms of gambling, perhaps machine gambling, are more individual pursuits, but there can still be that sort of personal challenge, I think. So we often talk about that as the illusion of control in gambling, thinking that you have some skill over an outcome that is, you know, defined either purely by chance, or in the case of sports betting, there's a modest skill element there, but gamblers tend to overestimate how much skill they've really got. You know, the other thing there, that desire to win, I think cuts across all forms of gambling. It's really part of the definition of gambling. Although quite quickly, I think gamblers kind of lose sight of the wins, or in a way they lose interest in the wins, and it becomes more about just the uncertainty or maybe the thrill of placing the gamble in the first place. And the wins become sort of degraded there.
Yeah, so I've won my $1,000 or my $3 playing bingo, but that's not satisfying. I guess it's the next game, it's the next bet that is the pull, the attraction.
Yes, yeah, and the uncertainty, yeah, the thrill of playing. And that also comes in the form of loss chasing as well. And if there's one sort of cardinal feature of gambling spiraling out of control, it's loss chasing, this desperate attempt, going back, either continuing within a session or going back the next day, still trying to claw back those debts that have accumulated.
Now, a little more concretely, the Center for Gambling Research, if I went to the Department of Psychology, assuming it's located there, what would I find?
Well, we're a lab. We're in effect we're a kind of regular lab. We have grad
white
students.
We don't wear
the white coats yet. Maybe we should. So we have a lab where we've actually got some real gambling machines, the kind that you could play in a casino. And this is a new approach for us. And there's only a couple of sites around the world that can do that kind of research. You know, out there in the field, in the real casino, there's a lot of different